we realized it would be more efficient for us if we combine those two assets.
The two big Alaskan cell phone providers merge their wireless services. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the challenge of rebuilding quickly in Galena.
Safe, affordable, warm shelter is the priority.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The two largest mobile service providers in Alaska have created a joint venture. The Federal Communications Commission approved the merger this week. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the companies say the move is designed to compete with national providers.
Alaska Wireless Network will be a subsidiary of both GCI and ACS. GCI will be the majority owner, and your bill will continue to come from the existing companies. David Morris, a vice president with GCI, describes the joint venture as a preemptive move against the larger carriers AT&T and Verizon.
We realize between the two companies that instead of building two cell towers and having two switches and two sets of fiber optic cable to provide the same service, it would be more efficient for us, reducing operating expense as well as capital expenditures, if we combine those two assets.
Morris says the new Alaska Wireless Network is for mobile coverage only, not home internet or cable. He did not give specifics on what it means for monthly rates.
If you look at the pricing right now, the local carriers are already less expensive than the national carriers. So we'll see.
The merger required approval from both the FCC and the Department of Justice. Senator Mark Begich serves on the Commerce Committee, which oversees federal wireless policy. He says the move is not anti-competitive.
You know, Verizon's going to play big. They're going to put a lot of capital. That's going to create some competition, even more competition than we have today. And then after that, we have AT&T sitting in there, and now you got three big players.
As part of the approval, Alaska Wireless agrees to expand rural coverage. Morris says the new company will provide at least 2G service to the bush. Some parts of rural Alaska will also get 4G coverage. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
FEMA Region 10 Administrator Ken Murphy is in Alaska this week to keep an eye on disaster response for Yukon River flood victims. Murphy spoke with APRN today on the agency's ultimate goal of providing services to disaster survivors to get them back on their feet as soon as possible. As of July 21st, FEMA has paid out over $1 million in awards to individuals and households in the damaged areas.
We continue to work with each family, and I think it's important to realize that we have people up there that are case managers that are individually working one-on-one with each family, you know, to try and make sure that we understand their needs and that we can support their desires, to help them out.
Murphy says FEMA staff has completed 285 housing inspections so far. The FEMA Disaster Recovery Center in Galena is designed to facilitate the application process.
Typical one-stop shop where we try and have everybody there, the state, the city of Galena, try and answer all their questions, stop rumors, get facts, you know, so that people get help quickly. And then, as I mentioned, we do a lot of face-to-face meetings with the family, and we'll continue that process of case management till we really see that the family has gotten what they need to support their efforts to rebuild their home and their life.
Murphy says disaster survivor assistance teams on site work face-to-face with each homeowner or business owner so that even if there is no internet service or an applicant is not internet savvy, the application process runs smoothly. Murphy says federal law requires an August 26th deadline for registration with FEMA for assistance, although disaster help will continue long after that.
some of the markers that we have is having certain things in place so that the school in Galena can open up, continue its normal education of the children. We have different markers about, obviously, the weather, but we're putting plans in place to try and have enough people, especially in Galena or Fairbanks, that can be there all winter long to help out. And that includes voluntary organizations, which I think are very key to the success of all of this.
FEMA works closely with the State Homeland Security Division on relief efforts in coordinating all decisions. The Fairbanks-based Cold Climate Housing Research Center is working with Galena residents whose homes were damaged and destroyed by the flood. CCHRC President Jack Hebert is visiting Galena today to share home designs based on past village housing projects and get feedback from Galena residents.
My sense from the people that I've been in contact with in Galena and our trips out there is that a safe, affordable, warm shelter is the priority. If they're energy efficient, if the indoor air quality is good, if it's something that they can afford and it can get done now.
Hebert says the short summer building season means things need to happen fast for new homes to be completed before winter. He says that's being complicated by concerns about future flooding.
This flood was, historically unprecedented. So does that become the new flood line, and all the houses need to be at least at that level to be insured? And also to be reassured that it's not going to happen again. If that's the case, we're going to have to drive a lot of pilings, and that needs to happen right now.
Hebert says the CCHRC is working with state and federal emergency response and financing agencies to get at least some work done this season. He says past experience shows construction can go fast.
If we can get the designs decided on, if we can get the financing in the way this is going to, be funded, in place, a lot can happen very quickly. Example, of course, in our world was Crooked Creek, where 9 homes were built in 6 weeks with volunteer labor in the local community.
Hebert says faith-based organizations are standing by to help build homes, and prefabricated wall and roof components can accelerate construction. The Cold Climate Housing Research Center is also working with Galena residents whose homes were damaged to make repairs that increase energy efficiency. Last-minute help has arrived for a remote village that is down to its last drops of treated water. Officials in Kashpur Kivalina had feared they would not be able to fill the water storage tanks anytime soon, saying they can afford to replace a corroded water transport line only if they forego ordering their next shipment of fuel. But a representative of a regional healthcare nonprofit, Manilak Association, traveled Wednesday to the Inupiat Eskimo community of 400 to figure out how to help replace the line. Kivalina imposed strict conservation measures after its pipeline was damaged by storms last year before the Inupiat community's water tanks could be filled completely. Residents are forced to take sponge baths, and some are collecting rainwater and river water to make do. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a graduate student discovers a new species of insect in Southeast.
I didn't even know what it was. I was like, I don't think it's a beetle. I don't think it's a fly. It looks kind of like a flea, but it doesn't look like a flea.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A bill making it easier to build a road to Prince of Wales Island mines has gotten some attention in the nation's capital. Congressman Don Young's measure would allow construction linking the island's road system to the Niblack mine. The copper, zinc, gold, and silver prospect is under development. The bill would allow that road to continue to the Bokan Mountain rare earth element mine. Both are in the southeast part of the island to the west of Ketchikan. It would be built in an inventoried roadless area, though, where construction is restricted. As a result, the Forest Service opposes it. Young questioned the agency's Leslie Weldon during a hearing before the House Public Lands Committee late last week.
Do you agree that if the road were built, it would help local Prince of Wales Island residents commute to the mine and live and work on the island?
We agree it's important that there be economic opportunity for the residents in Craig and Thorn Bay, but we think that there are more economically efficient ways of being able to transport those workers to the mine site.
Weldon said the administration prefers mine owners' boat people to a dock near the mine. She said it would be cheaper and safer.
It would be very expensive to build these roads because of the difficult terrain they would cross. Existing roads were built as logging roads, and it is not clear whether they are suitable for frequent use or whether the owners of these roads would support such use and accept any related liability risk.
Young said a road would allow for shipment of equipment and other goods. He also said it would cut pollution and power use.
We have an administration that desires to have clean air, and we have hydropower abundance there, but we can't move it if we don't have a transmission corridor, which would include the roads.
The bill's next step is a markup before the full House Natural Resources Committee. Similar legislation is in the Senate, co-sponsored by Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich. It has not had a hearing. An entomology student working on a project on northern Prince of Wales Island found a strange insect. It turns out it's an ancient and previously unidentified species, which she and her advisor have given a Tlingit name. KRBD's Layla Carey talked to the scientists and has this report.
It's not every day that an entomologist discovers a brand new insect, and University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate student Jill Stockbridge wasn't even looking for one. She was on northern Prince of Wales Island happily collecting bugs for her master's thesis, which focuses on how logging practices affect beetles and spiders. Stockbridge used a couple different kinds of traps to gather her bugs and then took all the samples back to Fairbanks to sort and study further. That's when she found it, again and again, a mystery bug.
I didn't even know what it was. I was like, I don't think it's a beetle. I don't think it's a fly. It looks kind of like a flea, but it doesn't look like a flea.
Stockbridge says her advisor, Derek Sykes, was out of town at the time, so she just set the unknown bug aside. When Sykes got back, Stockbridge brought out the insect.
His impression was that he was kind of disappointed in me and just telling me, well, at this point in your career, you should know exactly what it is that you're looking at, and so I felt kind of ashamed.
Sykes, an entomology professor and curator of insects for the UAF Museum, admits he was a little surprised that Stockbridge couldn't figure it out.
You know, I said, what? You don't know the order? And I look at it, and I wasn't sure of what order it was, which really, you know, that's just a real shocker for an entomologist to not really know what order something is.
With so little information about this insect, they turned, like many of us do these days, to social media. Turns out there's a bunch of other bug experts who are on Facebook and often use that tool to identify critters. So Stockbridge and Sykes posted some photos and eventually were able to identify the genus, Carinus.
Then we started figuring there was only one species known from this genus, and that's called Carinus dectes. But since that was found in Oregon and Washington, and that's about a little over 1,000 kilometers away from Prince of Wales Island, we started thinking maybe we have a new species, so we should start doing some work on it.
They did some genetic comparisons and found a 7% difference. Stockbridge says that's in the gray area when determining whether you're looking at a separate species. Then they examined it under a microscope to look for clear physical differences, but that didn't really tell them much either.
So I signed up for a scanning electron microscope class, and it was a type of microscope that lets you get really up close to these insects so that you can try to find really tiny differences.
With the help of that extreme close-up view, Stockbridge determined that the two species do have some obvious differences. The males have different numbers of lenses in their eyes, and the females from Prince of Wales have a shallow notch on their bodies, while the Oregon version has a deep one. It's not a huge difference, but it's enough.
So, yeah, and from there we just decided, well, what do we want to name it? And at first I wanted to name it after myself, but then my advisor was like, well, that's kind of arrogant.
So instead, they decided to honor the native tribes of the island and use the Tlingit word for ancient, Klagu, an appropriate name for a very old species. At first glance, the Klagu could easily be mistaken for a flea. They even hop when you touch them. But don't worry. They eat liverwort, moss-like vegetation, rather than blood. Sykes says the similarities are striking enough that the new bug might be a long-lost relative of the modern bloodsucker.
It's about the same size as a flea, shape, color, but it's not a parasite, right? So it's a wild plant-feeding, probably close relative to the fleas.
They sent some samples to another lab, which will look more closely at the possible relationship. Sykes notes that this new bug is among 300 species of arthropods that are found only in Alaska. More than that, so far, Carinus clagu has been found only on Prince of Wales Island. But he says now they know what to look for and how to collect it.
So now that we know how to find them, we can expand the search and look at other islands in Southeast, look on the mainland, and just see how far and wide it's distributed. I expect it's probably distributed much wider than just the north of Prince of Wales where we found it. I should hope so.
POW does have some special characteristics, though. Some species found there suggest that when the rest of Southeast was buried under ice, there were pockets of open land, allowing bugs such as the Jurassic Age Carinus clagu to survive glaciation. Stockbridge collected the bugs over 4 summers. During her annual trips to POW, Stockbridge stayed in Kaufman Cove, which she says welcomed her warmly.
Anytime I visit there, they always say, oh, the bug lady's back. So that's my name. Down there is the bug lady.
The bug lady says the discovery of Carinus clagu will form an interesting chapter in her master's thesis, which she hopes will be done in time for her to graduate next spring. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Lester Lunsford is still the mayor of Whittier, at least for now. According to the unofficial results, the longtime mayor is poised to keep his position following Tuesday's recall election. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, the recall stems from this year's hiring of a permanent city manager.
There are Whittier voters who still have confidence in Lester Lunsford as mayor, but the support isn't overwhelming. 55 voters showed their support for the controversial mayor during Tuesday's recall election, while 50 voted no. The recall was sparked by the city's handling of the city manager hiring process earlier this year. In March, the Whittier City Council voted to replace interim city manager Bob Pernella with Tom Bolin. Bolin was the only applicant interviewed from a pool of 7. The vote itself was controversial because Pernella wasn't given the proper 30-day termination notice. Some of the council members were not involved in the hiring process. Lunsford cited those members traveling as the reason. Later that month, the council voted 4-3 to officially terminate Pernella with the proper notice. The following month, 3 former city council members, Peter Denmark, Shawnee Phillips, and Dave Goldstein, filed an ethics complaint against Lunsford and city council members Mary Brenneman, Larry Bussman, and Becky Cotner over the incident, stating they did not act faithfully during the hiring process. Last month, they successfully petitioned for Tuesday's recall election. The remaining 23 absentee and 6 question ballots are scheduled to be counted and certified on Tuesday, July 30th. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Over 1,000 hatchery king salmon died at Blind River Rapids sometime last week. The Chinook were returning to the Crystal Lake hatchery on southern Mitkoff Island, south of Petersburg. Warm Water temperatures appear to be the culprit, KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game sport fish biologist Doug Fleming estimates 1,100 kings died, most likely on Wednesday, July 17th. Fleming says he discovered the die-off after last week's warm, summery weather.
Earlier in the week, I started monitoring the water temperatures and seeing that it was getting to the dangerous levels. And getting through till Wednesday, which was appeared to be the hottest day, and then on Thursday, I was conducting an aerial survey just to get a grip on how many fish may have been killed by the warm water, not expecting to see a large die-off, but some, and was shocked to see the numbers of fish that we lost at that time. So that was on Thursday afternoon after the weather had broke.
Fleming recorded water temperatures at Blind River Rapids in the 80s that week. He suspects that some combination of hot water, low oxygen levels in the water, and a large number of fish trapped in the fresh water of Blind Slough led to conditions the kings could not survive. The tides may also have played a role. Fleming says the die-off happened during smaller tides when the cooler ocean water may not have reached far enough upstream.
The tides were building. We were just getting a small amount of tide exchange. And it appears if the fish had made it through Wednesday night, they probably would have survived. We had a change in the weather, cooling off, and the tides are growing. They're very large now. I've heard reports that these carcasses are starting to wash out into the Wrangell Narrows, and there's a lot of tide now. So the remaining fish, our hopes are the remaining fish will use the high tides to get up towards the hatchery.
Fish and Game was forecasting 1,800 adult kings would return this year to Crystal Lake. That 1,100 dead includes adults as well as 1- and 2-year-old Chinook. However, Fleming says it's a sizable portion of the expected return that died. An unknown number of kings survived the hot water and can still be seen finning around the deeper pools of the rapids and the slough. Biologists won't know until later this summer how many kings avoided the hot water and still will make it back to the hatchery. Those kings normally start showing up back at the hatchery in early to mid-August. Crystal Lake has not met its goals for broodstock, those fish needed to produce future generations, for the past 4 years. The hatchery has been forced to rely on broodstock eggs from other operations in Southeast, and that could be the case again this year. The eggs cannot be salvaged from the dead Chinook, while the birds, bugs, and bears are making quick work of the carcasses. The Chinook die-off is not unheard of, and this year's is not even the largest recorded at Blind Slough. In 1989, about 1,400 fish were found dead there. Past 3.5 decades have seen 6 years, including this one, with fish die-offs topping 500 king salmon. Fleming says the poor water conditions have also occurred in other salmon streams.
There's other cases where it's happened with other species, whether it's pink salmon or others, than in some of the large numbers of fish that pile into a creek and then water conditions change. And then fish can basically suffocate and have large die-offs. But Blind Slough just does, the way it is, it's so shallow and wide in the middle portion of the slough. There's not a lot of shaded, deep, narrow channels to keep the water temperatures cool. Anyway, it's a difficult place to get fish through.
Fleming and others from Fish and Game on Friday recovered some of the heads to have them checked for coated wire tags. Those tags will tell biologists the age of the fish that made it back to the slough and help with predicting future run strength. A few chum salmon and hatchery cohos normally also start showing up at the rapids at this time of year. The slough has been closed to sport fishing for June and July because of the weak king run and to allow enough Chinook to return for broodstock. Fishing will reopen there August 1st. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
All of Alaska's currently active volcanoes are hundreds of miles from the scientists responsible for warning us of potentially hazardous activity or the likelihood of ash clouds that disrupt air traffic. Satellite imagery and seismic sensors give researchers a look into what's going on, but they depend heavily on citizen scientists for eyes and ears on the ground. The Alaska Volcano Observatory aims to improve the quality of ash forecasts through a new online tool. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the story.
The Pavlov volcano shot ash clouds to 28,000 feet this year, shutting down flights and dropping ash on Cold Bay and Nelson Lagoon. That eruption was the first time the Alaska Volcano Observatory received reports from its new online tool, known as Is Ash Falling? Christy Wallace is a geologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
We aren't anywhere near many of our volcanoes, and so we're pretty dependent on the public to make observations for us so that we can keep the advisory statements and public warnings current. And many times there's no opportunity for us to get out into the field and see any of these eruptions or even make collections and have physical samples. So having the public out there with their eyes and ears and watches, keeping track of things for us, I don't know if people realize is super duper valuable. We really, really need the public to make these observations for us. They're really our eyes on the ground.
She says scientists use satellite sensors and plug the data into mathematical models that can predict the distribution of ash.
If the winds are directed towards a community, we want to make sure that we can provide adequate warning to those communities where ash fall is expected. And it turns out that is the responsibility of the Weather Service. And so we at the observatory, the Volcano Observatory, are concerned about what's happening at the volcano, if there's going to be an ash plume produced, and when it is produced. We work very closely and directly with the Weather Service so that we understand, when the timing of ashfall as well as the amount of ashfall in these communities.
The tool was first developed for the 2009 Mount Readout eruption, but because the information collected can include names, it took 4 years for the federal government to approve it. The website does not publish any exact names or locations to protect privacy. Those who want to take the science to the next step can even send in a physical sample of ash.
That's really valuable to us because in some cases we may never receive a sample if it weren't for people out there in the public making collections for us. We may never see a physical sample. So that's another really valuable thing. And all of the instructions, video instructions and data sheets that you can download are all right there on that new Is Ash Falling website.
The tool is available at the Alaska Volcano Observatory website. A link to that is posted at kdlg.org. In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Ben Matheson in Dillingham. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.